Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. On Sunday, President Trump announced that the federal government is extending its social distancing guidelines through the end of April. That's a pivot from previous statements about wanting to open up the country by mid-April. President Trump also said that the death toll from COVID-19 could be up to 200,000 people in the United States, even with mitigation methods in place. As of Monday morning, right now, the number of positive tests of COVID-19 is nearing 150,000, and over 2,500 people have died from the virus. An important part of assessing the social, political, and economic impact of the pandemic is understanding where exactly on the curve we are now. So we know where we stand today, how much more of the pain is ahead of us versus behind us. So we're going to spend some time discussing that today. We're also going to take a look at why President Trump's approval ratings have hit their highest level since the beginning of his presidency. And we'll zoom in on the politics and possible politicization of the Defense Production Act. So a lot to cover today. And here with me to do it, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hi, Nate.
Hello, guys.
Also here with us, senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire.
Hey, Galen.
And managing editor Micah Cohen. Hi, Micah.
Hello.
So let's begin by discussing where we are in the arc of this crisis. Nate, I know you spent a lot of time looking into the various models and data. What's your assessment?
So it depends on what part of the country that you're in. If you're in, let's say, Washington State, where people have been taking measures for a long time, where it hit a little bit earlier, you might actually be a little bit on the downslope of this. If you're in New York, this is a very important week to track the data in New York. I would think some people would hope that we are at a plateau in New York. Although even if we're in a plateau as far as new cases, you still have people coming into hospitals and into ICUs faster than they're leaving them. But this week is important for New York, and maybe we're at that plateau. If we're not, then New York gets even scarier. If you're most anywhere else in the country, apart from Washington, California, and New York, you're probably still on an upslope. It depends. It depends on when your governor or mayor put social distancing measures into place. The thing to remember is that all the data we see in terms of new cases reflects what we were doing a week ago, 2 weeks ago, or sometimes even longer because of the lags between when you actually become infected and when you get a test, and then the further lag when that test actually gets reported to the system. So therefore, you know, the hope would be that social distancing measures that went into place a week or two ago will start to result in the curve flattening in parts of the country where those were pursued more aggressively. And after flattening, you might actually get some reversal where the number of new cases is down every day or a little bit. I don't want to create false expectations for people, but this is a week where, look, last week we knew things were going to be mostly pretty bad. This week is a little bit higher variance as far as you could see a mix of very bad things and some more positive indicators.
Claire and Micah, either specifically talking about this week or given the broader picture and some of the unknowns, how are you thinking about where we are in this crisis?
Well, I think we're kind of at the beginning stages, no matter how you look at it, in sort of the broad scope of things. Nate's right to point out that there are geographic differences all over the country, and obviously New York is just the undisputed and unfortunate hotspot right now. I mean, it's been interesting to watch how certain states, particularly southern ones, frankly, southeastern ones, are sort of reacting less aggressively with sort of quarantining measures. You know, you're seeing Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, I believe, kind of deeming a lot of businesses essential services, and so basically keeping a lot of places open. So different parts of the country are kind of handling things differently, and that could be 2 weeks or a month out really important for whether or not those places become centers of the outbreak. And I think it's just, you know, I think a theme that will continue to come up in the way we talk about this pandemic, both from an epidemiological and sort of data standpoint, but also a politics standpoint, is just like the tension between state control and federal control, and like what powers we have in this country to kind of crack down when there's a sort of intellectual thought that like we need unilateral strict behavior on how you're interacting with other human beings. And so right now, I think it's just we're in the really early stages, and I don't know if we want to get into this now, and Micah, maybe you can talk about this a little bit, but, you know, we've seen a few different scenarios for, like, the duration of our current state, you know, quarantining.
Yeah. So I don't want to, like, comment on the actual curve of this virus, as, you know, I'm not an epidemiologist nor a statistician, and so I, you know, it's a complicated thing I don't want to comment on. But what I will say is, like, my anxiety about this is, like, still on the upward slope, right? So whatever model of this virus I have in my head, now I'm in New York, so that's as Claire was saying, the locality matters a lot here. But whatever model I have in my head, you know, it kind of has not plateaued yet. There's sort of each day I'm reading about this, and it feels like each day I sort of take it a little more seriously, right? The rest of the country, I do think of what Nate said is important, that it does feel like, you know, Washington was first, New York is now the prime area, and that the rest of the country, in part because they're not taking it as seriously in some places and not doing as much quarantining in some places, it does seem like the rest of the country will quickly catch up, in a bad way, obviously. But that's just what it feels like to me reading about this stuff, looking at the responses to what Claire was saying about, you know, what timeline are we in? It does feel like we're still in the beginning stages of this.
Nate, President Trump described a trajectory on Sunday where the pandemic could be peaking in mid-April and that 100,000 to 200,000 Americans could die from COVID-19. I know that you've been looking at a lot of the different models, but is that in line with what the evidence and modeling at this point say?
Yeah, I think so. We publish an expert survey. We don't conduct the survey ourselves, but we publish it and make lots of charts and graphs around it. And those experts, as of a week ago, thought if they had to forecast one number, that around 200, 250,000 people would die in the U.S. So the estimates kind of from the White House of 100K to 200K is in line with that. However, that estimate is a point estimate when you have a very, very, very wide range, ranging in our expert survey from, I think, mid five figures in the kind of best reasonable case scenario, so 30 or 40 or 50,000, up to 1.1 million or more in the, maybe not the absolute worst case, but the worst reasonable case scenario. So, you know, on the one hand, I am glad that the White House has awoken to a reality where this is really bad. On the other hand, you know, there's a little bit of expectation setting. 200K is neither, frankly, a worst-case scenario nor a best-case scenario. It's kind of a modal case scenario. Number three, we still have a lot of power over what that number winds up being. We, frankly, not meaning as individuals, though you should socially distance, obviously, but we as governments, for how much we bend that curve based on how effective the measures are, how long they're in place, how overwhelmed medical systems are, and so forth. You know, one thing that also seems to be in line with the consensus is that we are talking about a peak probably within a matter of weeks and not 5 or 6 weeks down the road. What that means is that things are not spreading quite as fast as they were before, certainly not in places that took effective social distancing measures. But again, that's why these kind of next, frankly, 2 or 3 weeks are important for seeing how much has the spread slowed? How overwhelmed are systems, medical systems, I mean, and where are there new hotspots? You know, last week we had hotspots kind of emerge in Michigan, in Louisiana. There may be one in Florida. So how many more different problems do we have that we don't see right now? Because there's very good testing in some places like New York now, or let me say pretty good, not very good by any means. And there's really inadequate testing in other places. And so we don't even necessarily know where there could be problem spots.
Yeah, that kind of brings up a theme that we talked about 2 weeks ago, which is that we focus a lot on uncertainty in this podcast. And that's a large part of assessing both the public health and political and economic consequences of this crisis. So from where we are today, with maybe 2 months or so of this in the rearview mirror, what are the key unknowns? Claire, for example, what are you focusing on in terms of political unknowns, economic unknowns, or even public health unknowns?
Well, I don't want to get too ahead of a future segment we have on this podcast, but a lot of what I'm looking at is continued government response. The theme I'll harp on is federal versus state tension and how we're kind of sort of bureaucratically going about fixing this problem, because that, frankly, in this scenario, was sort of life or death. That's a big one for me, because this is probably in my lifetime the most clear-cut case of like how government action actually, like before your eyes, can have impact. But that sort of also spins out into, I'm looking at like personal protective equipment and the way that's being distributed, and innovations for, not for virus cures or anything like that, but just how innovators are kind of coming up with ways to clean personal protective equipment and reuse it. There's a biotech company in Columbus, Ohio, that sort of, you know, proffered something to the federal government and says, we've come up with these ways to clean, you know, masks or whatever, but that isn't in use yet because it's, you know, typically these things have to go through a full approval process. So to me, it's kind of interesting to watch some of the bureaucracy and regulation try to happen in really quick time in order to save people.
Yeah, I think those things Claire mentioned are really important to watch. Obviously, because, and maybe this is like too obvious an answer, but because they have a direct effect on just how bad this virus gets. You know, those death toll estimates we were talking about earlier, you know, if it's 200, 300,000, which, as Nate said, that's like in the meaty part of the probability curve, I think, that's a ton of people. Now, you know, you're talking about, I saw it phrased this way in one article, it's like roughly 3,000 people died on 9/11. You could see days, single days where that happened, right? So like, that dictates everything. That dictates, I think, the economic fallout. That dictates certainly the political fallout. And that still is the big unknown, I think, just how bad this is.
There's also, I didn't really know if this fits in nicely with the sort of broader stroke stuff that we're talking about, but just sort of watching people's personal behavior. Unfortunately, I've interacted with the medical system in the past couple of weeks, and it's still sort of shocking to see how many people, even at those places, are not practicing social distancing, or people will, you know, pull down their mask and let, you know, or if you go outside to just general places, you know, people 6 feet apart is actually further than you might think. So there's these little things that we're now supposed to be integrating into safe practice, and you see them spread a lot on social media and people saying it on the news, but it does take a while for it to trickle down into people's actual everyday life. And it's been a bit surprising for me to see even people who should be really well informed about this not take those precautions. And I kind of am curious how that will change over the next 2 weeks, month, you know, as we watch things, as our news consumption gets, frankly, you know, more macabre.
Yeah, I think there are kind of two categories of unknown here. One category involves measurement. So every single statistic that we look at with respect to coronavirus has some complications. The number of cases reported is very dependent on how many people we're able to test, and the number of tests can increase or level off or decrease in a given place in a given time, and that's pretty important. You might think, okay, well, we at least know how many people who die, but not necessarily, because whether you attribute that death to coronavirus or not is complicated. You know, and also deaths are the kind of most lagging indicator. People can be sick for several weeks before they pass away. So that gives us a window into how we were doing a month ago, maybe. Hospitalization counts can be useful, but on the other hand, if hospitals are overwhelmed, then that could hit capacity potentially. So it's very hard to kind of know exactly kind of how, you know, we know things are bad, we know things are very bad, but still there might be an order of magnitude or so that we don't know how bad is because of all these reporting uncertainty issues. And then the other thing is the things that Claire and Mike were talking about, which is like the behavioral issues. You know, I probably don't think about coronavirus like a normal person does, as someone who's both super, super high news consumer and someone who understands exponential growth and looks at a lot of data and projections. You know, I can say, okay, well, my anxiety level is steady because I got anxious weeks and weeks ago, and this is kind of the reason I was anxious. This is kind of in line with, frankly, how things might have been expected to go. But, you know, my question is, what happens after the anxiety begins to wear off, right? Mm-hmm. When people get used to the new, very difficult for many people, but still people kind of level set, people get used to the new temporary routine, you start to see more good news in the data, frankly, cases leveling off. And people start to say, hey, look, why are we still social distancing? This is probably 2 or 3 or 4 weeks from now, even in an optimistic case, right? People say cases are leveling off. Hospitals seem like they either had problems and got through it or not, but like it seems baked in. Why can't I go out to the playground? Why can't I go out to a restaurant? Why can't I go back to my place of work, right? And so, you know, I think because both anxiety and the data are lagging the actual reality on the ground, which is very bad right now, in some ways that like will be helpful on the downside because people will be like anxious and the data will be getting worse because it reflects what happened 2 weeks ago when things are actually getting better, and that will kind of buy policymakers more time to implement longer social distancing than people might kind of choose on their own. At the same time, we don't know what it's like. I mean, we're kind of, you know, I have a beard, Micah has a beard, right? And it's kind of like it's a passage of time, right? And it's kind of like, what is it like after 2 months instead of 2 weeks of homeschooling your kid, of not being able to go to your office, of frankly not having any in-person interactions with your friends or your family in many cases even? Will people start to fudge a little bit on social distancing? And the answer is you might think they would.
And also, I think that at that point in a news cycle, you might start to see more talk about the economic portion of this, or greater focus in news coverage on the economic portion of this, which I think plays to people's insecurities about the economy. I mean, I think a lot of people are probably in the position where they haven't fully processed what a essential shutdown of the U.S. economy means, like truly long term. And I think this is some of the issue, the sort of deep-seated issue with Trump's really confusing messages about when the U.S. will, quote unquote, get back to work. First it was Easter, now they've said, April 30th. But, you know, that doesn't seem particularly realistic for when Americans' lives will fully go back to normal, which frankly might not be for a year to 18 months. And I think our lax behavior once we've gotten used to things, or once sort of we see fewer and fewer cases. I mean, there's obviously still vulnerable people, older people who will be at high risk. So it'll be interesting to watch as that plays out.
Yeah. And when it comes to the oscillation between focusing on the economic impact and the public health impact, I mean, we've already seen plenty of that, and we're only on the upswing still. There was a really good article in the Washington Post about some of the unknowns that modelers have to deal with in assessing the public health risk. And it was actually basically saying that the politics surrounding this is its own unknown that you have to think about when you're modeling this out, because there are people who are calling the models themselves a hoax, for example, or questioning the public health science or the epidemiology behind the assessments that this is pretty bad. Now, Sunday, Trump kind of took a more serious tack. We've seen that before, and then he's backed off a little bit. So we'll see what ends up happening long term this time. But this political response at the federal government level and how seriously leaders are projecting this is its own unknown and will have its own public health consequences. The article, if people want to read it, are coronavirus modelers factor in new public health risk accusations, their work is a hoax. And that was by William Wan and Aaron Blake. It was a really good read from my perspective, at least.
Yeah, and to me, Galen, it's a great point that article was really good. And to me, that, among many other things, obviously, but that is just such a big shift, and it happened so quickly. But just like think about all the times during the Trump administration when there was just this kind of like nihilistic, nothing really matters, you know, sense to things, to what Trump did, to what the government did, to what the government didn't do, to what Trump said. And now all of a sudden we're in this situation where what Trump and the administration, and then as Claire was saying, the state level governments do and say has huge, huge impacts across the country and world. And it's just such a shift from 2-3 months ago, you know?
Yeah. By the way, this is random, but I'm just, you know, going back and thinking about like the way we're processing, or frankly not processing, like the economic impact. I just saw a friend who tweeted, who used to work at the Tampa Bay Times, who said, who tweeted the Tampa Bay Times is now cutting back the paper to 2 days a week. I mean, you know, there's just like a lot of stuff that's happening, like happening, and we aren't like, perhaps I'm speaking for myself where I can't fully process like the bigger impact of it, but it's happening like right now.
In the kind of ideal, perfectly rational world that we don't live in, part of what I wish would occur is that people would say, okay, all these debates about what is worth it as far as keeping the economy shut down for how long, right? Let's wait until we actually see empirically that the curve has flattened. And then those are good conversations to have, right? But let's wait for that first, you know. In the meantime, there are a lot of things that people should be thinking about in terms of how do you return to semi-normal? You know, what about wearing masks in public? There's some evidence that can reduce contagion quite a bit. Some people dispute that, right? But, you know, I don't love wearing a mask, but I would much more happily wear a mask if I can actually go out and do two-thirds of the things or half the things that I could ordinarily. You know what I mean? Where now I can do 10% of those things. What about testing people when they come into big venues, right? You get a temperature scan. Fortunately, fever is a pretty reliable indicator of COVID. And so temperature scans can do a lot of good, right? What about these 15-minute tests that you can get that Abbott Labs and others say they're developing? How widely available are those, right? Like those things are things that are pretty important. And the kind of time from when the curve starts to flatten, which I don't think we can say it has yet, to when we start to go back to normal, people should be thinking about those measures a lot because that would help prevent a second wave, help us get back to normal sooner.
Yeah. So now that we've established a little bit where we are in the scope of this thing and what unknowns still persist, I want to pivot a little bit and talk about how the American public is grading Trump so far on his response. So as of Monday morning, according to 538's tracker, President Trump's approval rating is at 46% and his disapproval is at 50%. Those are his best ratings, according to our tracker, since the days right after he took office. And so for a little bit more context, specifically on the pandemic, an ABC Washington Post poll from Friday showed that 51% of Americans approved of how the president is handling the COVID-19 outbreak and 45% disapproved. This is a question that I don't know that we have a perfect answer to, but to the best of our ability, why has President Trump's approval rating improved over the past couple weeks?
Usually when there's a national emergency of a scale, then an initial response by some voters is to, out of a sense of solidarity, tend to say they approve of the performance of governmental leaders, including the president more often. However, Trump has gotten a much smaller bounce than almost anybody else. He's gotten a much smaller bounce than other presidents in similar circumstances. He's gotten a much smaller bounce than leaders in the UK and Italy and Germany and France and whatnot. He's gotten a much smaller bounce than governors and local officials when they're polled. So I actually don't think the data is particularly good for him, notwithstanding the long term.
But Nate, when this first arose, I think I asked, you know, could we expect some sort of rally around the flag effect? And you immediately kind of said no, because the response from the president has not been a useful one or an appropriate one given the circumstances.
Right. But now we have more data. And the answer is that like there is a smaller response by a lot than there is in other countries. So if we are wrong to guess at the rally around the flag response, you still have to look at the fact that people do seem to be discriminating and saying, okay, yeah, I feel this, but also I feel a lot better about my governor than Trump. And by the way, in polls that test head-to-head results between Trump and Joe Biden, he has not seen as much improvement in those, which suggests that there are some people who are saying, okay, for right now, we're in this together. I'm going to somewhat approve the president, but I'm still going to vote for Biden, right? And so I just don't really, I mean, first of all, I don't think any of this is like interesting, to be honest. I know it's important for us to cover it. And I know like our readers like have a lot of questions about it, but like nothing that like we talk about like right now is going to actually have an effect on what the election looks like in September or November. Things that President Trump does or does not do right now could have a very big impact. And so I do feel like, I know we have to have this conversation. I'm glad we're having it. I'm glad we're covering it on the site, but like the news value of Trump's approval ratings right now, in my opinion, is very low.
I do think it'll be interesting to see where Trump's approvals are in a month. I think it's pretty fair to say that his response has just been unclear and muddled and sort of poor generally for, frankly, stopping the spread of the outbreak, or, you know, for the federal government taking it seriously from early stages. So he hasn't done, you know, I don't think the White House has done a very good job at this. But as we all know, politics is a lot about perception. And so it's interesting to see where it is now, you know, in the couple of weeks where Trump has taken it more seriously, even while he's giving, you know, misleading statements about when the country might open up. I'm curious to see where we are as a nation psychically in a month or 2 months with all of this.
Yeah, I do think the movement in Trump's approval rating so far has been interesting, kind of for the reasons Nate led off with, which is that you're seeing these leaders in other countries get huge bounces in approval. And there are a lot of aspects of the COVID-19 outbreak that lend themselves well to a rally around the flag effect, right? Where people say, okay, we're all in this together. We're going to support our leader, which is why those, you know, leaders internationally are getting a bump. So to me, the fact that he's gotten so little of an uptick so far suggests, as Nate said, that people are paying attention and are looking at the response that Claire described and saying, okay, that was not good. The other thing is, you know, erstwhile podcaster Harry Enten, well, this pod, he's still a podcast, but erstwhile member of this podcast, Harry Enten, wrote about this. And here we're reading tea leaves a bit more. But Trump is now doing, he's seen more of a bump in polls of all adults than in polls of like registered voters, right? In other words, what we're seeing to some extent is that people who are less tuned into politics, we're seeing more of a rally around the flag effect among those people, which is kind of what you would expect now, maybe with some hindsight here, that like people who have less of an opinion about Trump are more likely and are less tuned into some of the criticisms of his response to coronavirus are more likely to then rally around him in this moment. But some of the things that the research shows sustain a rally around the flag effect, I think are not going to be the case for Trump. So one of those is like a lack of dissent, right? Think about, you know, in the lead up to the Iraq War or the first Gulf War, there are these moments in American politics where it's not really acceptable in the establishment to criticize the president on something. Already we're seeing that not really be the case for Trump and coronavirus, right? I would expect that only to amp up. The other thing is, as we were talking about earlier, in all likelihood, this is going to continue to get worse. You know, if you think of this as a war, a lot of people have thrown out that analogy. Research has shown there's less of a rally around the flag effect when there are more casualties in a war, right? We're at the beginning of the casualty count here, I think. And so maybe the best way to look at this, the data so far, is that it suggests Trump missed a big opportunity politically that other leaders have taken advantage of.
And also that economic effects might be somewhat delayed.
Yeah.
Like if you are a manager at like a local coffee chain and that coffee chain planned to expand and instead they decide to close a location, right? Because there's not a lot of long-term business investment right now and those decisions can have effects for half a year. Then maybe you're out of work when you would've got a promotion before. And maybe you, by September, don't necessarily attribute that to coronavirus, but it still makes you probably less happy with the performance of the economy and therefore the party in power. So where we are in the sweep of the disease, and there could be multiple waves, the economic consequences are going to be not just short-term, but medium-term.
I guess to push back on myself, let me just ask this question. I think it is true that Trump could have gotten a much bigger rally around the flag effect had he responded to coronavirus more quickly and more smartly and more in more of an evidence-based way. But in an absolute sense, is this small increase in his net approval rating still a good thing? Or if we just like, if you imagined for a second that it was going to last till Election Day, that's a bit silly, but It's still, like, in an absolute sense, a good thing, right, for him?
Well, not if it disappears.
Yeah, I don't know what...
Then it just doesn't matter, right?
I mean, one question about the durability of the spike in his approval is that part of the rally around the flag theory suggests that when there's bipartisan agreement or work, et cetera, that that can help sustain or build on a rally around the flag effect. If there's going to be like stimulus after stimulus or bill after bill that Republicans and Democrats in Congress have to work together on and that the president has to sign, which we've already heard indications that this $2.2 trillion plan is not the last of what's going to have to happen in order to deal with this, does that mean that partisanship declines a little? I mean, already you've seen Congress's approval go up significantly. And does the fact that Trump is working with Congress on all of these kind of help him sustain that more long term? And from a broader perspective, just how long do we think this spike in approval could last?
I wouldn't try to predict how long it'll last, but I do think those kind of things, Galen, do help explain the small uptick in Trump's approval rating. You know, those are exactly the type of things that Trump didn't get to do before that he does get to do now. I mean, that's why I think, like, I'm a little worried people are going to be listening to this and we're framing an improvement in Trump's approval rating as a negative thing. Now, it sort of is. He missed a much bigger opportunity. But if it does last, isn't any improvement an improvement?
I mean, let's
put it like this. Right?
I guess that's the question. How long will it last?
Who cares? Because it's not going to last until November. Or if it does, it's for different reasons than coronavirus, right? It's because the response is effective. But like the short-term response isn't relevant right now. That's kind of why it's like, you know, and the thing is, like, if you want to look at like a long-term forecast, then the decline in economic expectations probably really, well, not probably, really, really, really outweighs like a 2 or 3 point improvement in his approval ratings for right now.
I think also one thing people who are on this podcast and people who listen to this podcast pay attention to things like approval ratings and put it and read it in the context of politics, electoral politics, almost intuitively. But I do think the way that most of the country is thinking right now, to go back to our rally around the flag effect, is it's not particularly thinking politically. It's more thinking patriotically, if you want to put it that way. And I think the patriotic mindset will last for a limited amount of time because we're all human beings and we're all whatever. And then we'll move into a period where it takes on a more sort of normal political valence. But I don't think we're there yet. So I feel like that's my way of reading it.
Yeah, I'll probably ask you this question again throughout the general election cycle, Nate. But when is the appropriate time to start taking the president's approval rating seriously as pertains to the general election?
Well, look, when does the curve start to level off is a question that is more important than anything right now, right? When the curve starts to level off, then one thing that will probably also happen is that you'll see Democrats make kind of more explicitly political arguments about their response and how they say, with lots of evidence, frankly, that it was bungled, at least in large parts. I mean, again, I don't know what else to say. Like, again, I don't think there's a lot of news value in looking at things right now while we're in the early stages of public perceptions of the crisis, at least. So, you know, look at it again when we're in a different place. In an ordinary election year, the answer would be that you would have, like, there's no bright line, right? I mean, first of all, at some point, the head-to-head polls become more important than approval ratings. You know, so that would be like, when do you take head-to-head polls seriously? There's no bright line. I mean, certainly when the nominee is chosen officially, the Democratic nominee, that would matter more, although because we have kind of a presumptive or at least almost presumptive nominee in Biden, maybe the polls mean a little bit more now because Biden's very well known. You know, after Labor Day, polls become a bit more accurate. But one analogy is, like, you don't want to look at polls right after the conventions because there's almost always a bounce for whichever party held its convention most recently. In the convention, when you see a party get a bounce, then you learn to wait until that for a few weeks after that wears off. And in fact, when a party gets a smaller than expected bounce, when they get only a 2-point convention bounce, when they're supposed to get 6 on average or whatever, that can be a sign that things are actually negative, right? So if there's that precedent, then convention bounces take about 3 weeks to a month to wear off. The problem here is that there is still new news every day. It's not like a giant tornado hit the U.S. and now we're recovering. There's new news every day and the situation's evolving.
All right. So we will wait and see. And of course, we'll be here to break down the numbers and the approval ratings as that all happens. But let's wrap things up today with a discussion that is a debate that is happening right now in large part between the federal government and the states, and something that, Claire, you've been reporting on a lot, and that's the Defense Production Act. So the president initially was reluctant to put it to use. Governors around the country have called on Trump to put it into action, which the administration has now done to some effect. So, Claire, to kick us off here, can you explain what the DPA does and doesn't do and why governors have wanted it invoked so badly?
I think there have been some sort of fundamental misreadings of what the Defense Production Act does. It has certain powers. It allows the government to basically jump the supply chain and get sort of first off the conveyor belt of needed supplies. They've used this before pretty routinely in things like hurricanes. And so now companies that produce personal protective equipment, those N95 masks you're hearing about, ventilators, those go first to government contracts. But the big power that's being talked about is one that basically has the government incentivize private companies to make these needed supplies. So the government is not nationalizing industry. It's not, quote unquote, like forcing, for instance, GM to make ventilators. It has to offer loans and loan incentives in order for those companies to actually produce the product. So it's actually pretty good for companies. And that's what happened on Friday with GM. GM was actually already in talks and sort of it's interesting that Trump chose to deploy this particular function of the act with GM, because GM was already sort of ramping up production as opposed to other, let's say, big industrial manufacturers, car manufacturers that weren't in talks with ventilator makers. But so there's the ramping up production part of it. And then the part of it that governors are really eager to see Trump put into place is basically a centralization of distribution authority of needed supplies. So right now, New York State and Illinois and Florida and Michigan are all essentially competing on an open market for needed supplies. And what they're asking the Trump administration to do based on need, right, based on where their need will be, you know, we're kind of on a lagging curve with the numbers because we're seeing stuff from that basically give us a picture of 2 weeks ago. So states should be getting supplies as, you know, what their peak will be in 2 weeks or a month. We're not really seeing that right now from the Trump administration. In fact, pretty alarmingly, we're seeing potentially some politicized use of sort of allocating personal protective equipment. The Democratic governor of Michigan said on Friday that vendors of some of these necessary supplies were telling her that they had been told not to send supplies to Michigan. You know, Trump has said some derogatory things about Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan. So that's, I think that really raised my red flags about how the Trump administration is actually sort of distributing these supplies. I'm rambling a little bit and I can let people jump in, but just in general, we should also note that there's a shortage in our national stockpile of needed things like ventilators. So that also adds to kind of the need for the DPA to actually go into effect.
Why was Trump initially hesitant to invoke the DPA to its fullest extent?
I think in part because of probably some misunderstandings of what the law actually does. I think a lot of reportedly the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was lobbying against it. Companies like GE were lobbying against the implementation of the act. I think that has a lot to do with the perception that it would nationalize industry. Again, it does take companies away a little bit from, you know, their normal business, but the government is giving them loans or loan guarantees or promising them, you will have orders from us for the next 18 months. This is not just a short-term thing. We will make this worth your while. So it's sort of interesting that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was lobbying against it, but I think a lot of it had to do with kind of private industry telling the Trump administration that they didn't want it to go into effect.
I mean, it is similar. We saw the same thing during the financial crisis from the Bush administration, where, you know, part of Republican ideology is anti-government intervention in the private sector. So So when the Trump administration and the Bush administration, you're starting from a place where these kind of, it's not nationalization, as Claire said, but it's government. It's sort of like a more, you know, active government.
A bigger role for government, yeah.
Yeah, a bigger role for government. So I think, you know, in all the reporting after the fact in the Bush administration's response for the financial crisis, you saw they were constantly sort of having to overcome those beliefs, right? Now with the Trump administration, maybe it's partly that, but also, and we've talked about this before, that the decision making in the White House is just so all over the place that maybe it's partly ideological, and maybe it's just partly it's a shit show there, and they couldn't decide.
I mean, I think those are a couple big things. One, Micah, yes, I think the parts of the DPA that would make a difference, especially in the short term now when states are really in need of supplies and they need a clear cut, you're getting this many, you're getting this many, you're getting this many. The Trump administration has been really muddled about even what its powers are under the DPA, which is pretty troubling. So its implementation of those basically just organizational powers have been pretty poor. But I think the thing to also mention here, which I talk about a bit in my article, which I think I do actually think is a decent explainer about like what we can actually do with this, the DPA. America is not the manufacturing powerhouse that it was in 1950 when this law went into effect, right? So we're still relying a lot on, even with the DPA in full effect, we're still relying a lot on buying these medical supplies from China. I saw a report just a few minutes ago that the first of 22 planned flights from China bringing supplies to the U.S. has landed in New York. We buy and depend on China for a lot of our pharmaceuticals, for a lot of our needed supplies. So U.S. manufacturing bandwidth needs ramp up time, right? They need to retrofit factories to make ventilators. They need to, you know, come up with plans. So this is not just a sort of snap your fingers and we turn into World War II powers manufacturing production. Like that's just not the manufacturing landscape of the United States anymore, which is why the sort of incentivization part with loans and all this stuff is important for the government to actually make companies over the next year, because this is a pretty much a long-term problem, want to make these supplies. But it's important to remember that we're competing with countries on a global marketplace for these supplies.
Yeah. To your point about the governors all competing against each other for the same supplies, that is in part reflective of the state-by-state response that we've seen. And to anybody who's been paying attention to international news throughout all of this, which I'm sure plenty of people have been because this started and got worse in other countries first, they see like national lockdowns, national responses. Is it just normal that the United States would have this more piecemeal state-by-state response that follows federalism? Or is this more reflective of the fact that the Trump administration isn't stepping into a more national role?
I mean, no, it's how the system is designed. Ideally, in a case like this, it would give you some redundancy, right? That the federal government advises a very high number or a fairly high baseline of things. I'm not sure exactly, because I'm not like a federalism scholar, I'm not sure kind of exactly what things the federal government can and cannot do. Like, I don't know if they can enforce a quarantine in a particular state, for example. But ideally, you would have both a lot of federal action and a lot of state and local action. So you can have both a high floor of stuff and tailor things to local needs. I do feel like when I read like coverage of the U.S. in foreign media, that they don't understand that we do have a federalist system and that we do deliberately devolve a lot of power to states and localities. And that therefore, it's a little bit hard to compare blanket-wise, the response in the U.S. to the U.K. or something.
Yeah, I mean, Nate, I think you're right on some level where federalism will always exist in a response like this because, correct, like, you know, you saw the conflict between Andrew Cuomo and Trump, where Trump said, oh, we're going to quarantine the tri-state area, and Cuomo said, hell no, that's a declaration of war, and I hope the president doesn't mean this. Pretty amped up rhetoric. So there's always going to be, I think, tensions over personal freedoms of movement. But the federal government does have not only a lot of power, but I would say an important role to play in, again, the organization and distribution of supply. Because if U.S. states and governors are competing against each other and sort of one state that doesn't have a lot of need currently stockpiles a bunch of supplies, whereas another state is has a huge outbreak and they are in a great need, that's where the federal government is supposed to step in and sort of, I mean, basically enact war powers, right? That's what the DPA is. It is a wartime power. So there is, so that's the use of federalism in sort of that organizational structure is, or the powers of the federal government is important.
When it comes to how the federal government is interacting with the different states, Claire, you mentioned that Trump was deriding Gretchen Whitmer, governor of Michigan. Do we have evidence that the federal government is actually playing favorites with federal aid? Or is it like, it seems like it because Florida got 100% of its requests filled when other states haven't? Like, is it clear that that's what's happening, or is this just a suggestion?
Well, that, to me, that's semantics a bit. So the governor of Florida is a big Trump ally. He's a Republican. And yes, he's getting all his orders filled. Now, Florida is a state that's getting, that has hotspots, right? You know, and it's got a lot of people coming from New York who vacation in Florida. So it's not that Florida doesn't have a need. But yes, there's a lot of red flags in addition to being raised about whether or not this aid is being distributed based on red or blue governors. And, you know, the governor of Michigan was pretty clear when she came out and said, these vendors are telling me not to, you know, are saying that they're being told not to send stuff to Michigan.
For my reading, it's not clear. I think you need more reporting on it because it's very haphazard. I mean, I think kind of one theme here is, what's the phrase I can't recall? Like, you know, don't blame malfeasance when incompetence is a likely culprit, right? I mean, I think the Washington Post and the article where they're talking about some of these anomalies were also saying that, like, if you look at all the data, there's like no particularly predictable rationale for why some places are getting more than others.
Right, but there might be a predictable rationale for certain states. So I'm not saying that it's some of it's not disorganization, but I do think in certain instances, perhaps it's not entire, you know, unless I think we've all learned this from covering the Trump administration. Unless he comes out, they come out and say, yeah, we did it for political reasons, you're always going to get an obfuscating response. But you can also, you know, decisions like this shouldn't be made on a personal basis, right? And so there are, I think it's very fair and should be questioned why certain states are receiving, you know, the full hog versus other states with similar needs are having a lot of trouble. I think that's a fair question to raise. But of course, Nate, a lot of this is based on disorganization. Some smaller states who have less of a problem right now are, of course, receiving fewer supplies than they might request because they're anticipating where their response might go. But I think it's probably both.
Yeah, the ProPublica did a little reporting into this that people can look up. And part of what they found was that Florida didn't ask for all of that much relative to its population compared with some other states that did ask for more relative to their population. So another factor in assessing all of this and why Florida may have gotten everything it asked for. But yeah, obviously that doesn't address what happened with Michigan. And Trump was pretty clear in how he felt about Michigan and not wanting to cooperate with the governor. I mean, he said point blank yesterday in the Rose Garden that he wasn't going to talk to governors who he felt were disrespecting him.
To some extent, you have an interesting issue in that you do have scarce resources that are kind of shared between states, and kind of all local and state authorities have some incentive to protect their constituents and get those, which it's a little bit like on like an online dating site where everyone exaggerates their height by 2 inches, right? There's a little bit of incentive to say things are not crazy bad, but to say, okay, you have your modelers and they give you a range of outcomes, and it makes sense for states to emphasize the worst outcomes, both because they want to keep people or reinforce people need to practice social distancing, right? But also because, like, they want to be prepared, right? And they want to make sure that they have the ventilators if and when they need them. But there is, like, a little bit of I don't think gamesmanship is the right word, but there are politics involved.
No, but totally.
How bad you project that your worst case or your modal case might be when you're trying to win supplies that you do need, but, like, other states need them too.
Which is all of that's totally true, Nate. And then it makes you curious how FEMA and the federal government are, what models they're relying on to figure out where things will be in 2 weeks and where places will need the most supplies. I mean, to me, that's, you know, the part that is really important to pay attention to, too, because you're right. States have a vested interest in amping up their own need. And I think, you know, the idea of a centralized authority is trying to be a little bit more sober about, okay, this place will need the most, this place will need the most, this place will need the most, and what their model says versus sort of states maybe more sympathetic ones.
All right. Well, I think that that's a wrap for today. We covered a lot of ground. Thanks, guys. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thanks, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Micah.
Thank you. See you, everybody.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.